by developing competence and the knowledge in nutrition, which perhaps might be in my masterclass or when people go through this period of weighing and measuring, that's how then you can develop this autonomy to pick and choose what you need when you need to do it. And that would be ultimate nutrition freedom, or as Alan, I think, says, enlightenment, that you don't follow this rigid plan for 21 days. And that's what I realized I really love about my masterclass, and what I love the realization at the end is that people feel like they have autonomy over their diet.
Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project podcast. My name is Patrick Cummings. As always, I am here with EC Sinkowski. Every week on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that will help you perform better, feel better, and live better. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. How are you, EC?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. I'm excited to chat with you about this. We are going to this week talk about the key concepts of flexible dieting as discussed in the book Flexible Dieting by Alan Aragon, one of the few books that you recommend. So I'm excited to hear more about why that is. We're going to explore the nuances of flexible dieting, its impact on motivation and outcomes, and how it can be individualized to meet specific goals and preferences. I'm excited to get into it with you. But first, we want to make sure you folks know all about the Lazy Macro ebook. You are crushing the 800 gram challenge, I am sure, and you're ready for the next step. That's what Lazy Macros is. Lazy Macros is when we combine the 800 grams of fruits and veg we're eating every single day with EC's recommended protein target. The best place to start is the Lazy Macro ebook, chock full of the rationale behind the strategy, best practices for how to track protein intake, and what to do if you follow a vegetarian or vegan diet, as well as much, much more. Now, this is not a lightweight 3-page ebook filled with fluff, I promise you. This is jam-packed with solid info, practical tips, and the kind of no BS advice that, of course, EC is great at delivering.
I don't do fluff, Find Patrick.
What's that?
I don't do, you can't fluff. Do fluff. I don't do fluff.
Literal fluff, or like the marshmallow fluff?
Oh, I would do that.
Do you do that?
No, I would do that.
Okay. OptimizeMeNutrition.com/lazymacros. You'll learn all about Lazy Macros and you get that ebook. All right, my friend. Let's start with the Flexible Dieting by Alan Aragon. Mm-hmm. Again, as I mentioned, one of the few diet books that you recommend. Give us a sense of what this book is about and maybe even just hint at why it is one of the few that you do recommend.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's closer now to 2 years that it's been out. So I'm, again, late to the party here and reviewing it. Came out in 2022 by Alan Aragon.
You're a slow reader. That's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes you 2 years.
He's actually somebody that I knew about for a long time during my CrossFit tenure as well. And I know there's plenty of times that I've Googled like protein timing Alan Aragon. So certainly somebody in this space that I've always respected his opinion. But I'm so glad he came out with this book, Flexible Dieting. In fact, he even says it in the beginning that he's always asked for a good nutrition book. And so this was his answer. And it certainly is. What I really like about this book is I also get asked by coaches or people that are just highly interested in nutrition and almost like they want a textbook. And I think this is a really nice blend. I know that's maybe not a great way to market things, but I think it's a really nice blend of you're going to get the science and it's not this hyped up story marketing stuff. And it's really a book that you would come back to for a specific section. And I already have over the past couple of years, even though I'm just reviewing it now, but there's been times I'm like, oh yeah, what does Alan say about that? And I'll just go back for that section. So, you know, yes, you can just read it front to back like a book, but it is also a great stand-in for something that you might want to reference. And so today we're going to talk about some of the takeaways. I don't feel a need to do a blow by blow on a book that I really like, and instead just kind of pick some threads that really resonated with me. And you can go to the book for all the details on how much protein does he recommend and timing and do I eat meat or not and all of the other details that we're not going to cover.
Okay. Two super quick context questions. Yeah. One, is he a scientist? Is he a journalist? Like, what is his perspective coming into this book? And obviously it's broader than just the book, but like, what is he coming in with?
Yeah. If I've got it right, he's got a master's of science and he's worked with clients forever, but he also is part of published research as well. And so some of the studies that I use frequently, what we're going to actually talk about one, he's part of. So he's got this nice blend of, he's certainly worked with clients. His background is more in the bodybuilding space, but he definitely works with kind of the recreational exerciser as well. And then, yeah, he's got his hand in actually publishing research, which is great.
Dig it. Okay. So I think the natural question is like, what the heck is flexible dieting?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really important, as we always do, to kind of define what we're talking about. And I think flexible dieting is another one of these words where a lot of us have different ideas or meanings. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think the word can be more nuanced than people believe. You know, I'm going to get to how he ultimately meant flexible dieting in the title, but I think in many circles, including our own, this term flexible dieting has become synonymous with doing macros. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the perception and really the concept, even if it fits your macros, or you'll see this as the acronym IIFYM. Yep. And that sort of has taken a life of its own in our space, or kind of the functional fitness space. And the idea there was, if it fits your macros, was, okay, well, I can weigh and measure Pop-Tarts and pork rinds and my ice cream, and as long as I hit my right macronutrients, then I'm doing, quote, the diet. And so Alan actually goes through some of the backstory of exactly how that came to be and why. But some of the background there is it spun off from a study where essentially people were giving macro targets and they considered that the flexible dieting approach versus giving those specific meal plans. But really, Alan's use of the word and the approach flexible dieting isn't meant to be a specific diet. It's not meant to be specifically macros, or if it fits your macros. Instead, it's meant as this style of dietary control. And that changes based on the individual's goal at the time. So maybe they might be counting macros for a period of time. Maybe they're just looking at one aspect of their diet for a period of time, a la the 800-gram challenge. Maybe they're, you know, just thinking about their hunger signaling or something like that. So it can go from a very qualitative approach to nutrition to a very quantitative approach to nutrition. But basically, the individual can pick and choose among the different diet strategies to best serve their needs at the times. And so there might be times when you have this more rigid control, and there might be times that you have more flexible control. And really, I couldn't agree more with this sort of idea of what flexible dieting is. And it's one of the reasons I love my clients to go through a period of weighing and measuring, but ultimately my goal is for them to understand nutrition enough to kind of pick and choose what they need to do at the various times in their life.
Okay. So there's two kind of big, as you mentioned at the top, but this isn't a blow by blow. This isn't a chapter by chapter, but there are two sort of big insights or big ideas that you want to pull from the book. One is related to motivation and nutrition, and the other is related to outcomes like health markers and weight, et cetera. So let's start with the first one, flexible dieting as it relates to motivation. What's there?
Yeah, this was actually a relatively small section of the book. You know, there's so much more in this book than, again, what we're going to cover. I just want to keep stressing that, because you're going to want to see all his details and scientific analysis. But the point here related to motivation that Alan was saying, that, hey, what makes a program adherent, why somebody's actually going to stick to this thing, is when it's individualized to the person. And not just individualized today, but this idea that 5 years from now, when their goals and their life changes, that we have to individualize the program to them. And so that's how he's thinking about, okay, how do we actually get people to have long-term success? How do we get them to stick to their various plans? Well, it has to change as their goals and their life changes. And he points for the rationale for this to the self-determination theory, which is one of these things that I'm sure I've learned about in some course at some point, but really hadn't thought about it in terms of how I approach and teach nutrition. And so self-determination theory is this theory of motivation, which, by the way, is like the perennial question for people, right? Like, how do I stay motivated to stick to the plan? Mm-hmm. But self-determination theory suggests that humans all have these three basic psychological needs: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. And this is what underlies our growth and development. Meaning, the more autonomy, competence, and relatedness somebody has, the more motivated they are going to be to reach their goal. And so autonomy is that kind of feeling that we have choice and control over our behavior. Competence is this feeling of mastery, being effective in what we're trying to do. And then relatedness is this feeling of connection. And so I really, really loved this discussion of autonomy. I think people often don't realize or think that's what they want when they're looking for a nutrition plan. I think out of the gates, they're thinking, just tell me what to eat. Just tell me what to do.
Yep.
Yet that's exactly the opposite of what's going to create this long-term adherence and motivation. That's going to get your short-term results, but ultimately you don't have the autonomy to figure out what you need and to make it super hyper individualized. And so by developing competence and the knowledge in nutrition, which perhaps might be in my masterclass or when people go through this period of weighing and measuring, that's how then you can develop this autonomy to pick and choose what you need when you need to do it. And that would be ultimate nutrition freedom, or as Alan, I think, says, enlightenment, that you don't follow this rigid plan for 21 days, right? And again, that's what I realized I really love about my masterclass, and what I love the realization at the end is that people feel like they have autonomy over their diet. And just to sort of see him pull that back to where there could be long-term motivation and success for people, I think was just a really nice loop that I don't think I had ever kind of processed before, again, in relation to kind of my nutrition. And that people who are really successful are finally at this place of, hey, am I figuring out the plan that really works for me? Or am I just trying to follow this, you know, 10-day, you know, crash diet for X event?
Yeah, that is really interesting. The argument that what we're all aiming for, and I agree with it, is this idea of autonomy. And yet so many people are saying, please just tell me what to do. Yeah. Give me the restrictions under which I will be successful. But that in and of itself, it runs counter to our really very natural need to for autonomy and agency and choice. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. We fight against our own natural, our best interests by looking for the restrictions. Mm-hmm. And we should be looking for success with as few restrictions as possible.
And to be honest, I think it's because we don't yet have the competence. Mm. Right. Which is the other point there is that if you don't have the knowledge, you're just like, oh my God, just tell me what to do. Get me out of this thing.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, let's develop the knowledge base. And that's going to lead you to this, the freedom land. the place of freedom.
I love that. Okay. So the second of those was how flexible dieting might lead to outcomes people want in terms of weight or health. So that's obvious as it relates to any diet or nutrition plan. Does it work? How does it work?
Yeah. Yeah. So I mentioned, you know, he considers flexible dieting not as macros, but as this level of dietary control. And we can kind of have two ends to that, where there's going to be times when it's more rigid and there's going to be times when there's more flexible. And really, this is essentially my principle six, that all diets control quantity to varying levels of precision. But yeah, just think about it as a continuum, one end rigid, one end really flexible. And the most rigid end perhaps would be, you know, you're weighing and measuring everything and you're perfectly hitting a certain number of calories and each of the macronutrients and each of the 28 micronutrients and each of the fiber types and all of that stuff. It's just like perfectly quantitative. And at the other end, it would be somebody who gives not a single thought about what they eat at any point, right?
Yep.
Now, as he points out, what we find is that when people have really rigid control, and it might not be as extreme as that end I just mentioned, but it tends to be associated with greater disinhibition in consumption. And disinhibition means immediate gratification or these impulse behaviors around eating. So it would be that phenomenon of overeating these hyper palatable processed foods that we've talked about before. And so the people that tend to have these really strong beliefs or diet rules around, let's say, good or bad, or no, I can't have this, or this big restriction, tend to also display greater disinhibition around those bad foods, which is another just sort of interesting pairing, right? Now, of course, there's some other factors that come into play when we overeat these things. We've talked about their addictive nature and so on and so forth. But we find that sometimes these rigid dieting behaviors are associated with higher BMI. That's an association study. So we can't say that it's the rigid diet behaviors that are causing the gain weight. Maybe they've gained the weight and now they're reverting to this and attempts to lose it. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to make this an advertisement for my masterclass, but just reading this book and then thinking about how I go about nutrition, that's one of the things that I really love for the students is, yeah, great, they lose the weight and they get on their plan to their faster 5K times, but they also get this mental freedom from all of these dumb rules and restrictions that they've been going round and round on, right? And they realize how much freedom they have in their diet and they don't have to be so locked into, no, I can't have this and it has to be at this time. Oh, and then guess what? When we look at the literature, it turns out that they are associated with kind of better health outcomes. And so Alan points out that most people, and I think this is actually also in the USDA guidelines, have about 10 to 20% of their calories each day can be what we call discretionary, where it really can be the Pop-Tarts and the alcohol or whatever else that you want to fill in it. And
Pop-Tarts and alcohol. Yeah. That's my nightcap every night.
Pop-Tarts and vodka. Here we go. But, you know, again, it's sort of just a trip. We talked about how people ultimately want freedom, but want these rules at first. And then when we get to this point of explaining, hey, we're trying to give you freedom in this diet, it can be surprisingly hard for people to put those rules down. And ultimately that will get them to their long-term success. Yeah.
Yeah. Super interesting. So how does he recommend tracking progress to determine if the method that the person is using is actually working?
Yeah. Yeah. No surprise. I really like this section as well. He gives this 3-point measurement system to kind of track on your progress, right? You're picking and choosing these different tools of what you're doing for dieting. Okay. Let's check in with your body weight, waist circumference, and then your lifting strength. So weight, I think, is obvious number on the scale.
Yep.
Second one is waist circumference. And he's using that as a really nice proxy for body composition. Yet you don't have to go to InBody. You don't have to go get in a dunk tank and spend whatever dollars of money to go check out your body composition. You know, waist circumference is not a perfect replacement for body composition, but most people will lose weight in their midsection when they're improving body composition. And of course, it's different than other body parts. Like if you start a lifting program and you improve your body composition, your legs, your back, your arms, all of those might actually increase in size. Mm-hmm. But generally what we find is when people are leaning out, they do lose weight from their waist. So that's a great, again, stand-in for body composition. And then the lifting strength, no surprise there. I'm glad to see a performance metric here to show that you're making progress maybe in a fitness outcome, but also then to kind of check in with the body composition and the waist circumference. Like, hey, maybe my strength is going up and that's why I see myself leaning out. And maybe that's why the scale is going up. So it's this nice kind of like triangulation of these three different points to really figure out what's going on. And of course, with the lifting strength, it doesn't have to be a one rep max. You could just pick, okay, what's the weight that I'm doing for 10 reps or something like that. You can look at total load lifted across sets, reps, and load to track your progress. But again, I think it's just a really nice practical way that people can look at progress besides, again, being so transfixed on that number on the scale. And I've kind of hinted at it already. I think what I love the most is that they're all super convenient. You know, it's one of the things I really appreciate about what Alan teaches and educates us on. And he doesn't give us stuff for the sake of science. He doesn't give us stuff that he thinks is necessarily the most accurate system. It's like, no, this stuff is all sitting around your house or your gym and you're going to be using it all the time. And you don't have to go out and you know, spend extra money to see your progress. The one other thing that I thought was interesting about tracking that my audience might not be thrilled to hear, our audience might not be thrilled to hear, is he actually recommends that you wait for a period of 4 weeks to evaluate how the program is doing. So keeping the diet the same for 4 weeks before you say, it's not working. Yep. I've said before on the podcast and what I recommend in my masterclass, a 2 week delay, not a 4 week delay, but you insert this change, give it at least 2 weeks of being consistent before you really say there's no change. And one of the reasons that he suggests the 4 weeks, he points actually to women with their cycle, just because of that water retention is going to be changing over that 4 weeks. But of course, just water retention for everybody in general fluctuates. And yeah, I'm going to tell you that, you know, people have 2 weeks feels like a really long time, you know, when you're living through the days and hoping to see progress and you're putting all of this work and things aren't changing. And so here he comes in with the 4 week idea. I'm like, thank you, Alan.
gives you some cloud cover to give 2 weeks.
Right. 2 weeks. Gosh,
it's at least it's not four.
Yeah, no. I feel like, you know, I'm like wild with my 2 week suggestion. So no surprise. We got to take these metrics to see how we're progressing, but we can't look at anything in sort of a day-to-day change and really try to figure out what's going on.
Super interesting. Any other specific diet recommendations worth touching on? Maybe specifically like things you, certainly that you agree with, but maybe anything that you disagree with?
Yeah, I probably have to think a little bit more on the disagreement side. I do want to touch on a couple things on the agreement side. Certainly he has a nuanced opinion on how he makes his recommendations, but I think it's highly overlapping. And there are these areas of diet recommendations based on age and sex. And those are questions that I get quite frequently, right? That people are wondering, okay, so-and-so says that I need to change my diet because I'm X age, years old, or because I'm male or female. And as we've said before, it's really your body size, how much muscle mass you have, your body composition, your activity level, and even your goals that are going to determine your nutrient needs, not that you're male or female, and not that you're 50 or you're 24 or whatever it is. Of course, there's trends. Women tend to be smaller, and we tend to be less active as we age. So that then affects how the numbers shake out. But ultimately, it's those factors that matter, not again, age and sex exactly. It's not that, you know, a perimenopausal female now needs 1 gram per pound of body weight because she's perimenopausal instead of having her normal cycle. So I just want to highlight these because, again, these questions do not stop, and that's fine. There's a lot of people who are promoting this idea, but thank you, Alan. Page 76, quote, the collective evidence does not warrant different protein intake levels between the sexes. Page 110, 10. That was on protein. Now, this one, as in the case of protein, the collective evidence does not warrant different carbohydrate intake levels between the sexes. And here we go on page 146, agreeing for the same thing with fat, also stating that the lack of sex differences makes sense, quote, considering the wide range of goals and preferences across individuals, was essentially nullify the validity of generalized sex-specific targets. Thank you, Alan. Thank you. We just spelled out for all of the macronutrients, we are not making broad sweeping statements based on male or female. And then he goes into examples of how he would go about and plan out people's nutrient needs. And guess what? He bases it on their weight, their lean body mass, their activity, their goals, not again, their sex or their age. Mm-hmm. He does talk a little bit about aging and the references that he cites. While they do recommend protein higher than the RDA, they are not as high as my 0.7 grams per pound, which, again, I just like to highlight that because everybody thinks, oh gosh, I hit 45 or I hit 35 or I hit 50 and I need to now go to 1 gram per pound. No, that's not what the evidence says. And Alan was also part of this team that this meta-analysis on protein intake. So again, we're pulling together research from lots of different studies. I cite it frequently. Basically, what they were trying to figure out is, where do we keep gaining muscle mass with our protein intake? And then where does it just become gratuitous protein intake? Like, I keep eating more protein, but I don't get any more muscle mass. And what they found is that the 0.7 grams per pound is where individuals were able to maximize their muscle mass. And then after that, they didn't necessarily get more muscle mass gains. This is a Morton paper in the show notes, but he was part of that team. Now, here's the nuance there. That's one of the reasons that I like the 0.7 number. There's other reasons, but that's one of the reasons I recommend 0.7 grams per pound of body weight protein. But whenever we give a number like that, we're talking about biology. Biology always has a range, and height's a really obvious one. You know, we could say the average female height is 5'4". Okay, well, we know not every female walking around is 5'4", and that said, most women, let's say 98% of women, fall in between 4'11 and 5'10. Of course, there's outliers outside of that.
I don't know who I'd be talking about,
but there's outliers outside of this range. But the point is, I could say something like, okay, women are 5'4", and this ultimately represents a wider range. And so the same thing is going to be true with these point estimates that we throw out, even the 800 gram number, and even this 0.7 number, that there isn't going to be a perfect number. And so when we look at the range that's represented that came up with that 0.7 number, we find a range of an intake of 0.5 grams per pound up to the 1 gram per pound. And so this is where Alan suggests, okay, for the people that are really looking to maximize muscle mass through their resistance training, to hedge their bets, they may consider eating that 1 gram per pound level. This is not particularly different than what I say. I've always been like, okay, we're going to be at 0.7, maybe upwards of 1 gram. I think maybe the nuance and how I approach it is I work with a lot of individuals who are, yes, they're active, and yes, they want to gain muscle mass, but they're also looking to lose weight. And they've also found that their diets aren't sustainable. So I really default to, okay, let's find this common ground number. Let's get those habits in place that we need, not just in terms of protein, but the rest of the diet. Let's check in our goals before we all of a sudden think, okay, I'm the outlier. I'm the 6 foot female, or I'm the 4'10 female, or whatever it is. And so I don't think there's a difference there. I just wanted to point out that nuance of, like, this is how people kind of bring their own experience and opinion to the data, right? I'm citing the same study that he was a part of, yet he might push people more towards a higher level of protein. And I might say, okay, we're going to start at the lower end. Yet ultimately, I think we both can find success for our clients, depending on what their goals are.
Anything else to wrap this conversation up about this book?
Not really. I always love that. Not really, but I'm going to talk. No, I mean, I just like to stress again, there's so much content in this book that is well beyond this review. I do not think that this was a review of the book. This is, again, my sort of things that resonated with me that
these
I thought
were highlights,
that were super interesting, because I think it's a really great resource. And especially somebody who likes the science and wants to have a great reference, you definitely want to get this one.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. That is, we'll put a link to the book itself in the show notes as well. If people want to do a quick get to it, get it on your Kindle, start going through it, we'll add that. So check the show notes. One more reminder about the Lazy Macro ebook. If you're crushing the 800 gram challenge and ready for the next step, that's what Lazy Macros is all about. Head to optimizemenutrition.com/lazymacros, read all about Lazy Macros, get the ebook. I promise you, you will not regret it. Thank you, EC. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening to the show. Thank you for your ratings and your reviews. EC and I will be back next week for a new episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.